Back when he was in college, Jason Dukas spent a summer interning with the U.S. State Department in their Beijing embassy, specifically in the cultural affairs section.
As they like to say, my bosses there, they called it the fun part of the embassy. So rather than actually doing research and writing cables, we were putting on different events, basically trying to communicate what the U.S. stands for and try to clear up any misconceptions about the U.S.
Jason had been interested in China for a long time. He spoke Mandarin, and he was studying international relations. So he knew a lot about the China-U.S. relationship. But nonetheless, he was really surprised to hear how some folks in China talked about the United States.
For a lot of them, a lot of local citizens there in China, most of their exposure to the U.S. is through the media, which, you know, makes sense. You know, they listen to American music, they have seen American movies. So it's kind of funny to then try to explain to them, no, the U.S. is not all like Sex and the City or, you know, any of these other shows that obviously are just a small subset of kind of American culture. I'd hear things from them like, unlike in America, in China, we really value family. And having to tell them, well, you know, I definitely hear that. I know that, you know, your culture is very much focused around family. But of course, that's a very important part for a lot of American families here in the U.S. You know, not everything is this individualistic culture that everyone else kind of outside the U.S. often thinks of.
Imagining every American as a glamorous, gossiping New Yorker may seem like a minor problem in the grand scheme of things. But as Jason points out, these kinds of misconceptions can actually make it hard to build productive relationships.
If other countries and other people really think there are such stark differences between them and Americans, it can, if not create, but at least aid this mentality of more of an adversarial relationship that it's, you are different than me, I stand for certain values, you stand for other values. But really, I think there is a lot more in common than people might initially perceive.
Welcome to Day One, a podcast about people using the Harris public policy approach to make an impact in the world, from their very first day at Harris and years into the future. Today, diplomacy. Across the globe, Harris personnel are working hard to improve the dialogue between nations, to inject nuance into tough conversations, and to get peace building down to a science. Today on the podcast, we'll hear from a few of these people. We'll talk to a Harris alumna on a mission to better understand state-sponsored terrorism in Pakistan. And we'll hear a Harris professor share what it takes to create a lasting peace after years of devastating conflict. But first, back to Jason Dukas, who was interning for the State Department in China. As Jason realized that a lot of people in China had these misconceptions about the U.S., he wanted to do something about it. And since a lot of these ideas had come from American movies, he figured maybe he could use American movies to fix them.
And so what I did was I basically tried to take movies that were sort of representative of different eras of American pop culture and kind of walk through each week, decade by decade, to kind of talk about, you know, how U.S. culture is not just one static thing. It's very multidimensional and also changed over time a lot. So the movies were everything from October Sky, kind of talking about the 1950s, to The Breakfast Club, you know, in the 80s, to Juno, kind of like the 2000s. And the funny thing was, to a lot of them, actually the most culturally similar, the thing that they kind of connected with the most was actually that October Sky movie, which was kind of more of the 1950s era, because they saw a lot of similarities from their own background growing up when China was kind of first just economically developing. A lot of them had more humble backgrounds, working in more like rural or industrial places.
That was a few years back. Today, Jason is getting his MBA and his Master's of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. He's had lots of opportunities to continue thinking critically about the relationship between China and the U.S., and not just in the classroom.
Hi, my name's Jason Dukas, a joint degree MPP MBA student at the University of Chicago. This summer, I had
Jason is the co-host of this podcast called Just China. In each episode, he and his fellow Harris students do a deep dive into some important Chinese policy issue. He's also taking classes on international business and public policy. Jason sees all these things going hand in hand because he's realized that if you want to build lasting relationships overseas, you can't just think about the story that the movies tell or just the economic story.
I think that they all are interconnected in a really interesting way. So, for example, like in this class that's really focused on Chinese financial markets and kind of financial regulation, which you kind of does sound like very much brass tacks, kind of down to the dollars and cents. You know, even in that first lecture, a professor still provided an overview of the Chinese political system, because to really understand the economy, you have to understand the politics and the history and to a certain extent the culture. People are starting to realize that you can't just keep these in very segmented kind of disciplinary fields, that there is a lot of value in actually combining all of these studies together.
You may not know that much about Pakistan, but you have certainly heard of it.
That's Sahar Khan. She's a Harris graduate who's currently a visiting research fellow at the Cato Institute. Sahar originally comes from Pakistan, but she's lived in the U.S. for a long time. And she thinks a lot about how Americans see her home country.
Even if you watch just comedy shows, right? Or certain shows like Homeland or CSI or any of these shows that have sometimes spoken about terrorism, you have heard of Pakistan. And, you know, even if you know very little of it, the one thing you might know might be something that's really negative, that it's just full of militants. And of course, that's not the case, right? It's not a failed country. It's very much a developing country. It's a country that's transitioning. And, you know, it has a really diverse population and it has a really rich culture and history that I think kind of gets overshadowed by, you know, current concerns regarding insurgency and militancy.
A few years back, Sahar was getting her PhD in political science, and that's when she realized she had the chance to shed some new light on how terrorism really operates in Pakistan.
The United States and the international community usually accuses Pakistan, and accurately accuses Pakistan, of sponsoring militant groups such as the Afghan Taliban, the Haqqani Network, and various other sort of non-state militant actors. Of course, Pakistan has maintained over time that it doesn't sponsor them, but there has been a lot of evidence in which the Pakistani military establishment and intelligence agencies, you know, facilitate these groups.
By facilitate, she means the military provides safe havens for these groups and lets them cross the border into Afghanistan, things like that.
But when I was doing fieldwork, I thought, well, we know what the military side does, right? And for the past 20 years, we've been very critical of the Pakistani military establishment. But what about the civilian side, right? I mean, Pakistan just had its third general election. It's technically a democratizing country. Civilian leaders have always had some agency, probably not as much as military leaders, but they're not a completely ineffective force. It's not a military state. And so I thought it would be interesting to see, well, we have counterterrorism agencies in Pakistan too, like we do in the United States, like the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. There's an equivalent in Pakistan. And so I was interested in seeing, well, you know, do they really counter terrorism? And if they don't, then what are they doing?
To find out, Sahar spent several months in Pakistan, interviewing police investigators, counterterrorism experts, judges, lawyers, pretty much anyone who had inside information about how the bureaucracy works and whether it's abetting terrorism. Now, Sahar is from Pakistan, so she's well acquainted with the culture and the norms there. But nonetheless, she says, as a woman in Pakistan asking intrusive questions about politics and terrorism, there were some challenges.
You know, what I learned was that if, as a woman, if you just speak confidently and continue to make eye contact, it wears them down. Because even though it's a, you know, patriarchal society, you know, they are very careful about how they interact with women. And I certainly got some personal questions like, you know, are you married? Do you have kids? Your husband has allowed you to come to Pakistan. He must be very liberal. So I definitely got questions like that. But again, because I've grown up in Pakistan, I kind of knew how to answer them. And I didn't take them too seriously or personally. And because they felt like I answered the questions accurately and I had an easy manner about it, I think they, you know, opened up more.
So what did she learn from all these interviews? Do these civilian agencies truly counter terrorist activity?
Some of them might counter them, you know, probably not as effectively as they would like. But what they end up doing a lot more is not only facilitating a certain state policy, but also violating a lot of civil liberties in the process.
This is not a simple conclusion. On the one hand, it reinforces Pakistan's reputation as a supporter of militant terrorist groups. But Sahar doesn't think it means the U.S. should give up on cooperating with Pakistan. In fact, she recently authored a report at the Cato Institute on this subject. In it, she argues that Pakistan and the U.S. can and should still improve their relationship, despite this reality she uncovered.
The United States tends to expect a lot from countries. And one of the things that I argue in the report is also that, you know, Washington needs to tone down its expectations of Pakistan. And also, just because Pakistan sponsors militant groups, which is not a policy I'm personally behind or anything, but since, you know, they already sponsor militant groups, they probably won't stop. But that doesn't mean that the U.S. and Pakistan can't have a productive relationship. And so it does add nuance to the general narrative within the United States about U.S.-Pakistan relations, and also just the foreign policy the U.S. has towards South Asia. And just because you may not have the perfect relationship doesn't mean that you don't have one at all.
When a nation is undergoing a major conflict, say a prolonged insurgency or a civil war, it faces a lot of extremely complicated questions. Do you keep fighting until you've obliterated the rebels, or do you negotiate a truce? And when the conflict does come to an end, what do you do with the rebel fighters? Do you punish them? Or should you try to reintegrate them back into society?
These are incredibly difficult questions to study, often because we don't have a sense of civilians' preferences about reintegration, about peace building.
That's Austin Wright. He's an assistant professor at Harris who studies conflict.
I think the closest that we've gotten to that in historical context is the peace referendum vote in Colombia, which, you know, failed in truly epic fashion.
Violence between the Colombian government and the rebel organization called FARC had been plaguing the country since the 1960s. But then, in 2016, there was a referendum asking voters whether or not they supported negotiating an end to this years-long conflict. And to the surprise of many, a majority of citizens voted no, not to negotiate a peace deal.
And I think what that example showed a lot of people in the international community is that even after decades of war, the public may not necessarily be ready to accept rebels back into their community. They might not be willing to grant them immunity or amnesty. They might want them to stand trial. They, if they rejoin society, may not want them to take on sort of high social class or high social status positions. They might want them to be farmers and shopkeepers, but not members of the military or an elected official. These are all really important things when we go beyond, you know, the Colombian context and think about ongoing conflicts. And of course, for the United States, from a military perspective, the most important context right now is in Afghanistan. Over the past 2 years, the Taliban's been rapidly expanding their control over territory across the country. For a while, we were concerned that ISIS was moving into Afghanistan. I mean, that's still certainly a threat. But what is the best way in principle to excise the threat of the Islamic State in Afghanistan is probably to bring together the government with fighters from the Taliban, right? And sort of bring them back to into the fold of a political process. It's just a recognition of the political realities on the ground right now. And if you think about this a little bit more critically and reflect historically about, you know, what is the greatest threat to a robust democracy in Afghanistan, it is the Taliban. And if the Taliban were a political actor, their incentives for protecting that system would shift.
They wouldn't want to destroy it. They'd want to be part of it and help uphold it.
Yeah, exactly. They now have an incentive to compete within the system using ballots and not bullets.
But not everybody in Afghanistan wants that. Recently, Wright and fellow Harris professor Konstantin Sonin have been studying who in Afghanistan most opposes reintegration. This research is possible because Harris has a special partnership with NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. For the last 10 years, NATO has been conducting nationwide surveys in Afghanistan every 3 months, asking Afghan citizens about all kinds of things.
You know, if an individual were to reintegrate, would it matter if they had killed a civilian? Would it matter if they had personally abused members of your community? And if they were to reintegrate, what status should they be allowed to take? Would you want them to run for public office or to become a local member of your jirga or your council? And very importantly, would you want them to become a member of the armed forces?
And Harris has access to that data.
You know, the evidence seems to suggest that individuals who had been exposed to violence at the hands of insurgents, if they had a preference, were significantly more likely to prefer individuals to take a low social status, fighters take a low social status. They're very much opposed to them becoming members of the armed forces, and very much opposed to them becoming political leaders in their community, either elected or unelected. And I think that's really important because it puts in, brings a knife's edge to the issues that emerged in Colombia, where even after the peace referendum, when the government sort of forced through a peace deal, a substantial percentage of the population did not want the FARC to be allowed to rejoin society, certainly as a legitimized political institution. This sort of clarifies that even in a completely different context, people may have the exact same preferences.
But that's not the end of the story. Wright is also looking at whether it's possible to change these individuals' minds. There have been various campaigns in Afghanistan to try to build support for reintegration. Campaigns in the form of radio and TV messages, posters, political speeches. And Wright wants to know whether they've been successful.
And what our evidence seems to suggest is that these campaigns are actually quite effective at shaping public opinion and shifting it towards support for reintegration. And so this is a context where it looks like people's beliefs and their attitudes may be quite malleable. And as we think about the investment, the enormous investment in money, in bullion, and in blood, if it is to see a return, it might be willing to sort of think more carefully about what kinds of campaigns can be used to enhance support for reintegration, to make the peace process even more viable.
Today, we've heard from three people who are working to promote diplomacy within and between nations. So, what about you? If you're the kind of person who wants to improve the international dialogue or use evidence-based insights to foster a lasting peace in war-torn countries, then Harris Public Policy might be the place for you. Visit harris.uchicago.edu to learn more about how you can make an impact starting on day one. That's it for today. This episode of Day One was produced by me, Jake J. Smith.